Welcome to The Learning Curve, your industry podcast on all things on enterprise learning. In this episode of The Learning Curve with me, Kenny, I'll be exploring the world of learning myths with my guest, Dr. Kuva Jacobs. Now, you might be asking yourself, what exactly are these myths? Well, let's just say we'll be clarifying the details in the podcast, but let me say this much. Usually it's a set of common ideas about how people may learn, and these are not entirely accurate. So Kuva will be providing us researched and analytical insights on learning theories like the learning pyramid and different learning styles, and revealing how there's much more to the story than you might think. In fact, taking these learning myths at face value can be damaging because they lack the full picture, even if they contain some valid messages. This podcast episode is a must-listen for all learning development managers, learning experts, and enterprise learning professionals, because you don't want to be caught in a learning myth. Hello and welcome, dear listeners, to another episode of The Learning Curve with Kenny. This is our first episode of the new podcast, and for that, we have a very, very special topic and a very, very special guest today. And the topic will be debunking of learning myths. And we'll probably move that a little bit to e-learning myths to be more specific. And with me today, I have Dr. Kuva Jacobs, co-founder of Emergent Learning and a specialist in learning consultancy. So, Kuva, welcome to our podcast. You're going to be the star today in helping us debunk a variety of learning myths.
Thanks, Kenny. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for being on. So, the other special thing is, Kuva, you're clear across the planet because you're sitting in Australia. So, we've definitely broadened the horizons of our podcast by having a person from Australia on. So, thank you very much for being available and bridging that time cap of, what, 8 hours now, I think it is? Yeah, something like that. So
good.
Quite a gap there.
Glad to be here.
Okay. So, Kuva, we already mentioned that basically you're a specialist in learning consultancy. So what kind of consulting do you do?
Great question. So our learning consultancy, we have a range of different learning services, right all the way from analysis and discovery, all the way through to modeling and building out different learning solutions and using, you know, evidence-based approaches, of course, and and then violating that using, you know, a lot of human-centered design approaches, because what we're really trying to do is create a real impact on the learner and understand the business context and then be able to design learning that will actually make a difference.
Okay, that sounds exciting. So you have a PhD in mathematics. How do you go from mathematics to learning? I mean, judging by what you've already said, I can see you have a very analytical approach. So maybe that's the crossover, or, you know, for our listeners out there and for me, how do you go from mathematics to e-learning?
Good question. So I started my degree was in maths and computer science. And what I found during my degree was that even though I got good grades, there was still a lot of topics that I didn't deeply understand what it was about. And so I wanted to actually visualize the maths and bring it to life. So initially, I did my honors, and what I did was I built out all of these flash modules where there were things like, for example, a mass on a spring, or, like, you know, I'd get a sorting algorithm and I'd color shade the different colors of the different boxes, and then you could see how each of the sorting algorithms would work differently. So what it did was it created this really visual way of learning that added to the traditional styles of learning and was helping the students to have a much richer experience and be able to get more insight into to why things were happening.
Okay. Okay. So moving on from there, how do you then come up to the topic, or how did you then grow into the topic of debunking myths?
Yeah, it's a great topic, and it's one that I kind of just fell into, I guess, with, there was just a bunch of us on LinkedIn who we were seeing the same topics over and over again that, you know, we knew that they weren't true, and yet there's this populous phenomenon that happens where, because something's got a nice carousel or it's got something catchy about it, then everybody likes it and it goes viral all over LinkedIn, even though it's actually basically being debunked. We ended up joining forces and created a little LinkedIn group. And since then, the group's been gaining popularity and growing. And, you know, a lot of people are starting to discuss which things are actually true and which things are not, and how do we debunk these myths in a way that is firstly going to have an impact, and secondly is also respectful as well.
Okay. So, and the name of your LinkedIn group is again?
Learning Myth Busters.
Learning Myth Busters. Oh, that's so cool. I like it. Okay. So, let's dive a little bit deeper into the topic of myths. So what actually is a myth? So for those, you know, let's find a baseline. How would you describe a myth so we have a baseline to work from?
I would say that a myth is, it's like a story, or, and, you know, it can even be, like it's something that happened and it's become distorted. So, you know, there may be some elements of truth in this story, but a lot of what is true in it is no longer true or recognized as no longer true. So, like, for example, you know, if you take Father Christmas, right?
The children's ones. Father Christmas.
There was some truth in that, you know, there was probably a man who was kind, and, you know, there were reasons why this myth kind of evolved of him, like, you know, the reindeer probably came from somewhere from the winter. I'm not very good with why Father Christmas, the symbology of it, but there's a lot of symbology around Christmas that actually goes back even before Christianity, you know, about the fact that it's in the middle of winter and people needed a festival to make themselves feeling better in the darkest moment of winter. And so a lot of the mythology around it is, you know, tying back to a long time ago. So there are some elements of truth in it. There are some things that are really good about it as well, but that doesn't mean it's entirely accurate. So we need to be a lot more skeptical about which parts of it are true and which parts of it we should be taking with a grain of salt.
Okay. So would you then say a myth is like a form of cliff notes for learning? Because in essence, a myth, the basis of the myth, if I understood you correctly, there was some type of thing that you wanted to transfer from generation to generation or from one person to another. So there was some type of meaning or a kernel of information that you wanted to transfer. So I don't know if you're from in America, we have like cliff notes, and cliff notes are like abbreviations of condensed versions of complicated works, like for Macbeth. So if you want to know what Macbeth was also all about, Shakespeare's Macbeth, then you can read the cliff notes, and it's a very shortened version of that. So would you also say a myth is something like a shortened learning information or something like that?
Well, not if you take it literally. So in the same way that...
Okay.
So in the same way that if you took it literally, that Santa Claus is actually going to come down your chimney and deliver you presents, you would have some very disappointed children, right?
Okay, I hope we don't have any disappointed listeners now.
I'm sorry. Sorry, guys.
That's okay.
I mean, most adults don't take theatre calls, which we are, except when they're watching movies. and they wish it was true. But I think the point is that a lot of these myths, they have been proven to be false in some way.
Okay.
And taking them literally is not being critical enough in your thinking. And it also can be quite damaging as well. So I have to get into a few of the examples to explain how, but it's not necessarily having a positive impact on the learners or their learning experience either.
Okay. Well, that's a perfect segue. So, because my next question was going to be, can you give us some examples of common learning myths? So let's start off with maybe the most popular one.
Well, before I get into that,
uh-oh,
I actually have a game that I'd like to play with you.
Okay. I'm a player.
All right. So I've got a couple of sentences, and I'd like to see how well you can remember these sentences. And I'll explain a little bit more about why afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I'm now partaking in a live experiment here.
Yes, totally. It's just like you feel a bit like my children now, right? Because we just sit alive all day long.
Okay. Go ahead. Let's see what this is about. This is not going to be graded, right? There's no grade that comes out of here. So otherwise, we're going to have to change my podcast from Learning Curve to Bell Curve, because that's usually when I do best. So. But okay, so go ahead.
All right. First sentence. Ready? I want you to remember every single word, or try to. Okay? No writing it down. Ready for it?
Yes.
Okay. Everyone should subscribe to Kenny's podcast right away.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Now, second sentence. Wisteria, wattle, banksia, manuka, waratah, bottle brush, orchid, magnolia.
You're kidding, right?
They're the same length, these two sentences. All right, they're exactly the same length.
Oh, no.
All right, you said you didn't like numbers, I went with a non-number example.
At least do me the favor. Could you repeat the second sentence again? Because I heard something of magnolias,
That would be biasing the result.
Oh, so, I could only hear it once. You didn't mention that.
Okay, so what was the first sentence?
The first sentence was, everyone should subscribe to Kenny's podcast immediately.
Well, pretty close.
Everyone should subscribe to Kenny's podcast right away.
Full marks. Look at that.
Woo!
Love it.
Okay.
So There were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's 8. So you got 8 out of 8. I'm giving you a score.
Okay.
All right. Second sentence. The pressure's on.
Magnolias.
That's the only one you remember.
The problem was, to be quite honest with you, I went into shock. Because I was expecting a sentence, and I had already started, in order to achieve the best outcome, I figured what I'd do is repeat the sentence in my head, and then I'd try to make a story out of it, maybe, out of this, depending on what the second sentence was. And then you came out with just single words, which didn't have, there were single words. So I was shocked, and that put me at... made my brain freeze, to be quite honest. And after that, I was like,
magnolias. I was thinking to myself, how am I going to memorize this? I was in a panic mode. So what was the sentence again?
No, that's fine. All right. The research has been done. You've performed perfectly. Just perfect.
Okay.
That was excellent. Okay. So now we have the learning pyramid is the third myth that I would like to talk about. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So according to the learning pyramid, we learn 5% of lectures of what we hear, 10% of what we read, 20% of audiovisual, 30% of demonstration, 50% of group discussion, 75% of practice by doing, and 90% of teaching others.
Okay.
Now, the thing that's really interesting about that is those two sentences, right? They were both the same mode. They were both lecture. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
According to this learning pyramid, you should have only remembered 5% of both of them. Then you did really well.
Okay.
You beat the learning myth. You feel better now?
I congratulate myself on that. I beat the, okay. Okay, like so there we go. So
right, now.
So right off the bat, you've already presented us with a popular learning format or theory, or what would you call it? A learning theory.
Yeah. So it's a learning theory.
Learning theory. Yep. And right off the bat, we've already debunked it in a live test. Then.
Correct.
Right. Okay. Wow. Yep. Fantastic. So that's how quick it goes.
Yeah. So the good question to explore here is, why do you think we debunked this myth? Like, what was the difference between those two sentences?
Well, the difference was that for me, at least, the first sentence was, how should I say, a complete sentence. Versus the second part was just a listing of items. So when I thought of it, I had two different memory modes because the first one is a story or something, or I mean, it's just a complete sentence. So I had a feeling that's a different way to memorize it because. At the end there, you have to make sense out of something. So there's something that has to, at the end, comes out of it. Unless you pick, you know, a completely arbitrary sentence that doesn't make sense. But in general, your statement has to make sense at the end. Versus the other thing is just arbitrary terms that are put together, which don't necessarily have any relationship to each other. Correct?
I trace them very specifically. I'm offended that you think they're just arbitrary.
Well,
I mean, they're all flowers.
The first sentence, it really sounded arbitrary to me. I mean, I can't, like I said, I can't remember more than magnolias. So, I mean, what else?
So they're all flowers is what they are.
Okay.
But they're, you know, the point is that the first one, you're creating a story, you're attaching meaning to it, and it has relevance, right? The second one is very abstract. It doesn't have any meaning related to it for you in that particular context. And so therefore, because it's quite random, then it's very hard to understand. So the point between these two sentences is that it's not just about the mode of learning. It's very much about what we're learning and how we're learning and why we're learning as well. Because, for example, if I hadn't said to you, hey, like today we are going to learn these eight flowers type and we need them because they're the ones that are going in the bouquet that you're preparing later on for this thing, wedding that you're helping your friends with or something. There was some reason that you specifically needed to know that. All of a sudden there's a motivation, there's a context. There's all these different things that are going to help you to learn as well. And so that's why the learning pyramid is very much flattening out learning. It's not taking that context into consideration.
Okay. So how then, okay, I was going to ask, you know, what the craziest one was that you heard, but maybe we can get into that later, because I think at this point, how then, why, what under what circumstance, I mean, the original thought when somebody postulated this idea of the learning pyramid, there must have been some type of general idea behind it. So, and it gained a certain amount of popularity, and then maybe it, you know, got to a point where it basically, it was never questioned, because that's how it's always been, kind of type thing. And now you've, of course, dismantled it in about 2 seconds. So how does this come about? How does a myth come, in this sense, come into being, and how does it persist? And I think that's one of the key things that you do is the persistence of something, although it's been proven to be not correct, right?
Yeah, so it was, getting ready. The learning pyramid was first created by education specialist Edgar Dale in the 1940s.
Okay.
So he referred to it as the cone of experience. Back then, it didn't have any statistics associated with it, any nice, round, convenient numbers to help you remember things. It was just about the different methods of learning, which totally makes sense that, you know, one method of learning, generally speaking, might, you know, work better than another. But fact is that if you take this literally, that's where you're going to fall over. So, you know, it's trying to prove a point that, you know, we shouldn't just lecture at people. And if you think about Edgar Dale, this was back in the 1940s when people were very much lecturing at people, like, this is very traditional modes of learning, and he's trying to flip their thinking into creating learning that's a lot more constructivist, a lot more, you know, human-centered, involving the students, getting them to talk and think and have discussions and all that sort of thing. So the underlying message underneath this is very much a great message, and I totally agree with it. I think that where it really falls over is, first of all, the numbers that are associated with it, which don't necessarily mean anything. And secondly, like, there's no research or scientific evidence that's backing this up, because again, anything that we look at, like, for example, practice by doing, it's at 75%, but I can give you so many examples where I've done something and I have not remembered at all. Like, for example, if you do dancing, you know, that's something that, like, if you dance, if you do a dance class, you've done the whole dance, right? Would you be able to remember it the next day?
Maybe. Depends. Yeah, maybe. Well, I would say part of it. Depending on, at that point, it becomes, for me personally, at least from my experience, it's a matter of focus. If I focus enough on it, and really, really committing it to memory, then yes. But if I don't focus on it that much, then I probably would miss a couple steps.
So if you did a dance once and like a complex one, would you be able to remember 75% of it the next day?
Ha, now that's a good question. And that's, I guess, that's exactly where you're leading to, is the percentage, exactly 75%. To be honest, I'd have to test that. But I would probably go with no.
I don't think we can test it on a podcast. That might
it'd be a little awkward. But I mean, the first one, but still, it still brings me back to the initial question, though, still, is... okay, so we had, this was set back up in the 1940s, and there was a valid reason for it. But From what I understand, it's still being used and applied in the same manner as it was when it was first created. Maybe it's gone through a couple iterations in that additionally percentages have been attached, which makes it even harder to sustain. So why does a myth like that still sustain itself? What is the reason for it still being out there? And obviously, since you had to crack down on it a couple times, why is it still so persistently being used?
I think people are really attracted to, the nice round numbers, and they don't necessarily think too hard about it. It's just, become popular, basically. So, they see the pyramid, they see, people make nice, pretty graphics about it, and then they just want to share it and, propagate it because there's something in it that resonates with them, and so therefore they think it's correct. They don't question it any further.
Okay. Now, would you consider, is it mostly when you stumble across items like this, is it mostly regular individuals, or is it actually learning professionals that also propagate this? I mean, because if it was just, regular individuals, then of course you might be able to, understand that a little bit more easily because you're not a subject matter expert, so to say. So you might just take whatever figures, and obviously this pyramid has, I've not heard of the pyramid explicitly, but I've throughout my education, I've heard about the idea, generally if you read something, you retain it at this level. If you read it and write it, then you retain it at a higher level and so forth and so on. So even there, I've heard of it. So have you noticed that, like I said, that basically learning professionals also propagate this and stay with it, or is it more people that are not knowledgeable on the subject?
All of the above, definitely. Yeah.
All the above, and, really?
Yeah, and one of the things that's interesting about myths is that when people re-question them, you would think that if someone said to you, hey, this has actually been proven not correct, that that would make the person go in a way and explore and read a little bit and see whether or not they just, propagated something that was false. But what we've seen is that, people often will just ignore it.
Really?
When we tell them that it's not correct.
Okay. Yeah. Is that a modern phenomena? Is this whole thing, social media and word of mouth propaganda has, always has different effects, and social media has probably been one of the biggest influencers on, popular thought. How is that being leveraged? Does social media actually make it easier to either propagate these myths and continue to propagate them because it's, another form of word of mouth? Or is it easier for you then to challenge myths like this with the use of social media?
Well, we're obviously challenging what we say. And trying to do it in a way that is respectful. But we also find that the myths themselves will just literally go viral sometimes. And, us commenting on them is actually adding to the virality of the post as well.
Okay.
And the people who are posting, if it was me, I would want to take it down straight away if I didn't take it down straight away, I would be quite apologetic and thankful for the fact that someone had showed me something different to my current worldview.
Okay.
A lot of people are just very happy with getting attention on social media.
Okay.
So they have more engagement, and they just ignore the fact that someone's calling them out.
So how does that work then? Since you just mentioned Do you have an example of such a topic that you recently had that we can talk about on the podcast that went like completely viral?
Well, the Learning Pyramid is certainly one. The other one that just refuses to die is Learning Styles. So that
Learning
is
Styles.
Yeah.
Okay. So that is let's delve into that a little bit. Give me an example of learning styles or help me understand learning styles.
So the most common learning styles is it's called the BARC model, which is visual, auditory, kinesthetic, and reading and writing. I didn't say that in the right order, but yeah. So reading, writing, and kinesthetic. Basically, that's one example of a learning style model. And it has actually been, proven incorrect numerous times by science, and beyond incorrect, almost harmful, because you're putting learners into these different boxes. And the interesting thing was that I did remember putting something about reading styles in my PhD. So I went back and looked at my PhD to see, oh my gosh, did I use this model as well back in the day before I knew better? Well, what I'd actually written in my PhD after doing research on this topic is that there are 18 different learning style models.
18. Okay.
18. So how is any of them going to be correct?
Okay.
So the bottom line with learning styles is that learning styles really depend a lot, not just on the innate preferences of the learner, but also what learning is being consumed and how as well. So for example, going back to our dancing example, how well do you think that you could do a dance by reading about it in a textbook?
Probably not very well.
So no one shows you any of the moves. You just have to read the book and then you have to do it.
Mm-hmm. No, well, not good. If I just had to read it, I would have to, if I just solely read it and on basis of reading it had to then perform it, I think it would be very tough. I would probably have to aid myself by maybe, mapping out the steps on the ground or something like that, or adding some type of, flashcards or something that I could somehow remember what to do when.
Yeah, exactly. Because the thing that you're learning is very visual and kinesthetic, right? Which is two of the other learning style types. But the style that you want to use applies to the learning itself and not to the person who's learning it.
Okay.
And the second example that I can give you in contrast is, let's imagine that you are learning Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want you to be able to learn Spanish purely using the kinesthetic mode, which is about basically through simulations and videos of objects. Or you can also use the visual mode, which means no text, just symbols. Do you think you could learn Spanish with just symbols?
No, not a chance. Because, obviously, I need the vocabulary. So just symbols would not allow me to understand the language at that point. No, I would say no. There would be a chance for me to learn it just by speaking, I would say.
So then your preferences in that example would be oral auditory and reading and writing.
That would be my preference.
Which is exactly like basically the opposite of the dancing one, right?
Yes, most definitely.
So basically what you've shown here is that learning styles don't apply to you because it depends on what you're learning more than anything else.
Okay. But there's one question that's burning on my mind. If one of the biggest things is that, I guess, when creating myths and learning styles and so forth, I think what most people are trying to accomplish with that is like an ease of use, you know, like to compartmentalize things. So it's all nice and tidy, and you can say this and then it fits. But you're basically debunking most of these by saying that everybody's an individual and that there's circumstances and different things that might need to apply different things in different manners. But how then do you find a unified learning methodology for a group of individuals? Because everybody's an individual. So how do you find that medium to cover both people that, you know, learn with one type of learning style versus another? How do you put that into one model? Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So we certainly do it at Emergent Learning the way that we do it. And there are a few different models that do it. The way that we do it is through human-centered design. So
through
we
what, please?
Follow human-centered design.
Okay.
So we follow human-centered design practices, but not good. So there is generic human-centered design, but we use a very tailored and learning-specific mode of human-centered design to actually elicit the context and the requirement of the learning and the learning outcomes and, you know, explore things like how are people going to learn? You know, for example, if you're, like, let's say you've got two courses that you're building. One course is for field workers, okay? And they're installing a piece of equipment. And they're basically out on the road all day. They've got iPads, and they're never in the office. So it's hard to schedule a day off for them because you always have to have, you know, certain number of field workers out there. And they have time, but it's usually like in between appointments, like when they're waiting, you know, they'll drive from one house to another. When they get there, then they've got a few moments where they could do some learning.
Okay.
So compare that with a call center team who they are at a desk, at a computer all day long. They are in calls most of the day, but they have scheduled 15-minute blocks of training where they're sitting at their computer. And during that 15 minutes, that's when they can complete their training. So if you were to go in and ask these questions and understand the context of how these two people learn, how these two groups learn, and then you've got your requirement, okay, what do I actually need to teach them as well? And let's say one of them is learning about a new software system and the other one installing a new piece of equipment. So in these two examples, they're learning quite different things, or I can make it even more different by saying one of them is learning some, you know, communication skills, right? So the way that I design the learning for that group, that audience, is going to be very different from the way that I design the learning for the field workers. Like if I take those two groups, I'll take the information about how they learn, where they learn, how much time do they have to learn, what device are they using, all of these different things, they all are going to help inform the choices of how I'm going to build the training. And as well, what the intent of the training is. And, you know, what is the type of learning? Like, for example, oh, the guy out there needs to remember the 10 different types of flowers so that they can pick them up for their customers. So then that's another type of learning. how are we going to make sure they remember all of these flower names? What are the ways that we're going to build that up in their brains?
Okay, but that still means that, so you're analyzing the environment and the circumstances under which the training takes place, correct? But where does that leave the individual though? So, I mean, how much does the individual factor into this? The individuals, because the exercises we've done, you know, mainly focused on my way of learning things, so and not in the context of the environment that I'm in. So where do those two things differ?
What I personally would be looking for is like personas of different learner types, because you're going to have a few different learner types, and the variation between those learner types depends on a lot of things. Like, you know, you're talking about the modes of being the biggest variation between learners, but what if actually the biggest variation is not the mode, but the level of advancement that they're at in the job? Because if we go back to our call center staff and we're talking about communication skills, the guy who's just started is going to have very different communication skills to the guy who's been there for 3 years.
Yes, most definitely. Okay,
so
interesting.
In that case, if I gave exactly the same training to the two people, again, it would be completely off as well.
Okay, so you have to basically take a lot of factors into consideration when creating that training and trying to tailor something for individuals and groups, right? So,
correct.
Highly complex. Okay, that sounds, blows my mind.
So, I hope that answered the question.
I think so. You gave us a very good insight. I like the transition that we made basically from the myths into how then, you know, we apply new learning methods and so forth, and how you actually go about then